Hello, everybody. This is New Books in Psychology, and I'm your host, Eugenio Duarte, in New York. Today, we have Sherry Amadenstein with us. She's a licensed clinical social worker and psychotherapist practicing in New York City with expertise in relationships. Her prior books include the Q&A Dating Book, as well as Love Lessons from Bad Breakups. She's here today to talk about her new edited book entitled How Does That Make You Feel? True Confessions from Both Sides of the Therapy Couch, published in 2016 by Seal Press. Sherry, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about your book.
But this anthology is something very close to my heart. So I became a therapist later in life. My first career was in journalism. I worked at magazines and websites. And then when I became a therapist, I kind of came to it all googly-eyed, I guess. And I was very excited to do this. It had been something I'd wanted to do for most of my life. But also coming to it a little later in life, and also with at this stage of the game, we have social media, we have Google. You don't have so much of that blank screen, you know, because the idea of therapy is that the therapist is kind of whoever you want the therapist to be. Like, you don't really know who they are or much about their personal life. And a lot of people are always wondering, well, what does my therapist really think of me? And what do they think of what I'm saying? And all of those things. So I really came to thinking about this book as not lifting all the boundaries away, obviously, because I think that's an incredibly important part of therapy, but in illuminating to people, what is it like for a therapist? How do we feel? And the anthology has 34 essays. Some are by therapists and some are by patients. And all the therapist essays, none of us are really outing our patients in any way, but we're writing very, very personally. And so somebody reading this will really have a clue of what it's like for us to be in the room and what we really think about our patients and how they impact us. And you know, that was sort of the genesis in a lot of ways, coming out somewhat from that blank screen, because I don't think that's totally viable anymore in this day and age.
And so I find that one of the most interesting parts of the book is that it has contributions from therapists and patients. I mean, you could have done a book with just contributions from therapists, and it would have been fascinating. How did the idea come to you to ask patients to contribute, and how did you even get patients to write about their therapists in such intimate ways?
Well, none of them were my patients, but these are all professional writers. Sorry, like Patty Davis is in the book, Dennis Palumbo, you know, Molly Peacock, a lot of Beverly Donofrio. So these are all people who have been writing books and articles and confessional pieces for years and years. And the idea of this for me is I've seen anthologies that are just from the patient's point of view. And what I wanted to do was something where you saw both. That was the whole fresh point of the book to me. And I just kept reaching out to a lot of people who I saw. I have like a lot of friends on Facebook who are, you know, professional writers and in the media. And whenever I saw somebody would even mention anything remotely about therapy, I would sort of like leap like a shark. You know, oh, by the way, I'm doing this book. And I wanted a vast array of very intimate and interesting stories from all kinds of viewpoints. And the book is a real range. I mean, as you saw, I mean, from funny to almost tragic to the whole, to great therapists, not great therapists, the whole range, really.
I want to go back to the therapist side of the equation, because as a therapist myself, I read a lot of therapist writing, and I happen to think that as therapists, we're much more comfortable writing about our patients' intimate experiences than our own. I mean,
absolutely.
We occasionally write about our quote-unquote countertransference, but I've always wanted more out of our field when it comes to the truly naked, confessional writing that I find in your new book. Do you agree with that? And was that a factor in publishing this book?
It was definitely a factor. And it was also very difficult for a lot of the therapists to do this. A lot of the patients also. I mean, coaxing the pieces out of people was like doing therapy in a lot of respects. In fact, there was a couple of very well-known therapists who opted out at the 11th hour because they just, in the end, did not feel comfortable releasing this kind of story.
How long had you been thinking about writing a book like this?
Probably the idea came to me 4 or 5 years ago. And initially, I was going to do this. I was going to call it Shrink/Shrunk, and it was going to be a blog. And I found someone, a professional writer, again, not a patient of mine, who I was going to do it with, we weren't going to be writing about, obviously we weren't working together in a therapeutic way, but I would write something and then she would write something kind of mirroring her feeling about whatever the experience was that I was writing about it. And we just did a couple of blogs and then she felt uncomfortable at the nakedness of it. And I thought, wow, this is like really tapping a vein. And I kind of just really wanted to keep tapping that vein in a larger way. So after the blog didn't work out, I thought, I really want to do this as bigger than a blog would have been. And that's when I came to the idea of doing it as a book and soliciting lots of people.
It's interesting to hear about all the resistance that you encountered along the way. And it makes me think about the first story, the opening story titled, I Really, Really Hate You by Beth Sloan.
And that is a pseudonym.
I imagine. Well, I got to tell you, I love this story because, first of all, it's really, really honest, but also because it contains a simple but very clear message, which is don't treat patients that you can't handle. I think a summary of the story would be it's about a therapist basically who treats a person with narcissistic personality disorder. And at the end, the moral of the story is that's not for her. And going forward, she's not going to do it anymore. What do you think of the story? And do you endorse the advice or the lesson that the author takes away at the end?
And in fact, she participated with me in a reading a few nights ago at the book review in Huntington. And we still used her pseudonym. We didn't use her, her real name. But I felt it came up. It led to an interesting discussion from the audience about how can you treat somebody if you really hate them, if you really don't like them, if they make you so uncomfortable. And it's very, very difficult to do that. And if I've had that experience where some people have walked into my room and into my office and I will wind up telling them, I don't think that we're a great match together. I'd be happy to help you find someone else. Because I think it's very, very hard to work with somebody when you have that who is so toxic to you. And it was very, very difficult, as you saw in the story, for Beth to do it. And I feel she should have perhaps opted out earlier, but she felt that she was doing what was in the best service of the patient, but she was happy when in the end the patient finally left. But that was after working with her and being uncomfortable for years. That's a heavy price to pay.
Why did you start with this story in the book? Is it meant to set a certain tone?
Well, because it is so provocative, and so I kind of wanted to splash cold water on people's faces, like, hey, this is the real deal. You really want to know what it's like for therapists? This is it. So that's why I chose that story to lead off with.
I wonder if you've had any responses to this story, perhaps from supervisees or therapists in training who might be thinking so early in their career that they have to be ready to treat everybody, that they can't turn anybody away. What would you say to them?
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's something that's a very interesting story to bring up in a supervisory session because they do need to be aware that this is going to come up and it's going to you know, really hit all your triggers, and how are you going to respond to it? You know, where are you going to be with this? I think that trainees have to be aware, this is rough work. You know, you can't just call this in. And so you do have to make, I think, decisions and choices. And yeah, I mean, they are counter transference and all of those things are going to be very much in the room. So I think that this is almost an object lesson, this story.
Yeah, and it's a lesson in therapists knowing and acting on their limits.
Yes, there are limits. We have to figure that out for ourselves. Absolutely.
One of the themes that your book also deals with, I think, is the limits that sometimes the general public feels, particularly how some people are really reticent to go to therapy. And I'm thinking about the story entitled Therapy is for White People by Janine Holmes, which is a story about a black patient who's driven to therapy in spite of her culture stigma against it following the death of her white boyfriend. And she ends up dealing with her late boyfriend's family rejection, and then in the process ends up going into psychoanalysis for what seems like much longer than she had anticipated. What did you think when you first read this story?
Well, I thought it was, and we actually, that story went through a bunch of drafts. We had a lot of phone conversations about that because I kept, you know, asking her to go deeper, you know, into it. And because it was such a fascinating story. It was so fascinating because you do have somebody, as you know, as she said, I mean, her culture, you just kind of get on with things and you don't go into therapy. And she was sort of driven to therapy after this tragedy that turned her life upside down. As she said, she had like this Jewish mother who kind of was a therapist who kind of like led her into it. And then she wound up, after just, you know, kind of wading in, really diving off into the deep end, because she was in it for years and years and years, multiple times a week. And so she found it so helpful in terms of figuring out who she was and how to handle tragedies and where she wanted to go in her life. And it was very difficult for her to come out to her family to tell them that she was in therapy. And then they just sort of took it in stride. And she still checks in with her, you know, with her analyst, her analyst is the one who told her in the end to leave. She still would have continued.
Wow. I wonder if you don't mind sharing a little bit about where it was that you wanted this author to go deeper. You know, where were the points of hesitation? What parts of the story were the hardest to write about or share?
Well, I felt like in her earlier drafts, she really wasn't going deep into what the therapeutic process was like and what it was bringing up in her. It was kind of more skimming the surface and more general. And I think she was kind of wading into the story the way she waded into therapy. Like, it was because she's been out of therapy for a while now. So I think it was hard to go back for her to what that was like and touch all those painful issues again.
So in a way, is this someone who you asked personally to contribute a story?
She was suggested by Susan Shapiro, who's another writer who's in the book and a writing teacher, and Janine was one of her writing students. So she suggested that Janine send me the story. And I mean, I loved it right away. As I said, I just thought it was just skimming the surface. And, you know, I wanted the story to go much, much deeper because I saw the potential was there. She's a beautiful writer and that she could do it. So that's why like doing this book really was like dragging people back into therapy.
Well, you know, I'm so fixated on that story because it's so interesting. And in a way, I wish that there were a counterpart story telling the therapist side of a story of events. And I'm wondering, in your own practice, have you dealt with people who come from a culture that stigmatizes therapy? Or how do you handle it when a patient drags himself or herself to therapy, but there's all sorts of stigma and secrecy about it? Like no one can know that he or she's in therapy. How do you deal with that?
Well, I have a private practice, and I'm also at a clinic a couple of days a week, Long Island Consultation Center. And the patients there, I mean, a lot of them are, they're mandated, schizophrenic, bipolar. It's like the rainbow coalition of where they're from and what their cultures are. So, and their ages. I've had people come into therapy, I mean, in their 60s, in their 70s, all around, who've never done therapy before. So there's a lot of resistance and a lot of fear and a lot of, oh my God, I can't tell anybody and what will they think of me. And plus I do marital counseling, that I've written 3 relationship books. So couples come to me because they see that. And I like when people come to me for premarital counseling before they get married, and often they feel like, oh my God, if we come, then we're saying that we don't really love each other, there's something wrong. And I'm like, no, it's kind of the opposite. It's saying that you respect yourself and your partner enough and you care enough to want to have this work as best as possible. So, but yeah, but it is, I mean, I'm sure in your own work too, it's very interesting when people come to therapy who have no experience in it, they're reticent, they're perhaps hostile, and then, you know, you have to go to where they are and proceed at their comfort level and hopefully help them along the process.
And I think some people do come in with the idea that therapy is for white people, and so it sort of lets you know where the work needs to begin. I learned from Ed Levinson that it's important to always meet the patient where they're at. And something I try to live by. You know, I wanted to bring up Molly Peacock's story, Not Even a Smidgen, because it also I think addresses some of the stereotypes about psychotherapy and particularly psychoanalysis. This is a story of a decades-long analysis that turns into a friendship.
38 years.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about the story is that it's not clear if at some point it turns into a friendship after the analyst has a stroke and loses the ability to practice. And I appreciate it because it shows what a long-term analysis is like, and I feel like that kind of treatment is taking a hit these days. How do you feel about this story and about what it might do for the reputation of psychoanalysis currently?
Well, and she started the story by saying it was never an absolutely classical analysis. It was more like exploring a vast chambered nautilus shell, say the size of a small planet, for 38 years. Yeah, I mean, I think this story helps to show that analysis, it's a relationship too. And 38 years, you're each a part of each other's lives, and, you know, in some sense, for sure. And after her therapist had the stroke, she was very happy to be contacted by the therapist to continue a relationship. The therapist can't, you know, really talk very well or communicate that well anymore. But Molly was going to her, I think, like once a week or something, and like taking her out for lunch. And I just thought it was lovely. And it just shows how things can grow and change, I guess, you know. So I see it as a sort of comforting story, actually.
Yeah.
Of what analysis can be.
What, for our listeners who may not know the difference between psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, do you have a way that you think about the difference between those two?
Well, I do psychotherapy. You know, I'm an LCSW, and, you know, and I think part of like what I do, I consider myself kind of like psychodynamic, but really like eclectic. You know, I do cognitive, I kind of do what I feel is going to work for this person. And, you know, and I'm not, I mean, I've been doing therapy now for, I guess, 9 years. And I have some patients who have been with me since that started. But, you know, analysis is, I feel analysis is more where the therapist is that blank slate, and where the therapist is not as participatory, I guess. Like, I'm fairly active in the room, too. I mean, I don't know how you are in the room, but I kind of lead them when I feel that they're ready to be led, or I try to. And, you know, patients of mine who have come, because some of them have done, like, analysis, and it just feels like in some cases where they felt like they were just in the water blindly swimming at some periods.
Yeah. Your story is, I appreciate it because I, or at least I hope it can give people a more realistic look about what psychoanalysis can be and how useful it can be. Or even if one is not doing psychoanalysis, how helpful it can be to stay with a therapeutic process for a bit of time. Do you see people long term?
Some of them, I mean, I've been doing the work for 9 years, and there are people who've been with me for that period of time. So
you know what it's like.
Yeah, so I do, and I really, yeah, and I also often say to people, I think it can be, the work can be much more interesting when they're not coming in with a crisis du jour.
Right.
You know, because then you can really delve and go to new places and discoveries versus just, you know, when you just keep repeating the same pattern and the same story week by week to week to week. And I think it takes a long time till somebody can look at their stuff and not keep falling into the same crevice to really then go to those new places and open up in a whole new way. So that, I think that's something that you probably can't achieve as well with short-term therapy. I think you do need a long, you need the spaciousness.
I want to talk about your story entitled Therapist Without a Clue. It's so personal. I mean, you really walk us through your inner experience of seeing patients on your birthday, and dealing with your own losses. How did you feel about writing this story, and how did you pick this particular slice of your life as the one that you wanted to share?
It was, and you know, I've been writing, I started writing when I was 9. And so so my writer self, and I think that writing and therapy and becoming a therapist go hand in hand. They both involve, you know, listening and really having that curiosity about people. So, but this story just sort of, it just bubbled up, I think, for me. It just was there. And I felt, how can I do a book where I'm asking therapists to open up about themselves if I don't do it as well? So it was hard to write. It took me a very long time to write this story. It was really difficult.
What do you hope readers take away from the story?
Well, I think also this story is a microcosm of what I think the book is, which is showing that we are flawed too. We are imperfect too. We have our issues, we have our stuff, and you know, there's no, and we're all more similar than we are not. And so I guess I kind of wanted them to see that a therapist is not this otherworldly being. I have my own stuff, but that doesn't mean that I can't be there for you too, hopefully, anyway.
You mentioned Janet and Sandra. Are those pseudonyms?
Yes.
So I wonder if you imagine the real people in your life about whom you're writing, do you imagine them reading this story?
Well, actually, one of them is now, I mean, we're in each other's lives, and she's a very, very close friend, and she has read the story, and we've totally healed together. So it's okay. And the other one might read it at some point, but that was never the deep friendship that way. Because in the story, I talk about these two friends who sort of left me and these abandonments, and how it's, you expect, like, you know, lovers to leave you, but when, you know, female friends leave, it's very difficult. So Janet is the one who is not in my life anymore. And she's the one who sort of triggered this story because it's on my birthday. And I'm pondering, you know, Janet, who was this friend of mine last year, she took me out for my birthday. This year, I didn't even get a text. But that brought me to the deeper loss, which was a very close friend, Sandra, who was like a spiritual sister. And we had done a business together and done a lot of things together. And then, you know, she sort of disappeared. And I didn't know what happened for 7 years. And that was the pain, the not knowing. And so in the story, I didn't want that again. I wanted closure. So I called Janet and, you know, and she said to me, well, I just don't love you anymore.
Wow.
But it was like, okay, at least you said something, you know? And that's kind of what I really wanted. I wanted the closure of it. But the one I call Sandra in the story, and where she was the much deeper relationship, and she and I are back in each other's lives and closer than ever, so.
That's really great to hear. And you know, what's so cool about the story, Sherry, is that you take us right to that moment in the consulting room where your patient is describing what he's going through, and it just so happens that you're going through the same thing and you're sort of privately holding that in mind. And I am sure, because I've gone through this, I'm sure so many therapists have had that moment where they can't believe the uncanny resemblance between what their patient is going through and what they're going through. I mean, do you have a general rule about what you do in those moments to kind of ground yourself?
It's very hard. I mean, as you know, it's so hard to do that. There was last week, there was a therapist in there and she had lost her husband. And she had someone come in that week who didn't know and just said, oh, you don't know what loss is. And I just, you know, and she was just sitting there, the therapist, thinking, oh my God, yeah. And she didn't tell her. She didn't tell her. So as you know, these are hard situations. I mean, I remember a few years ago, when my father died, and I had to cancel my appointments. You know, it's like I was thinking, do I tell any of them or do I just say I have to cancel? You know, and there were a couple of them I did tell because they had known that my father had Alzheimer's and I was, you know, helping to take care of him. So I think it's kind of figuring out who can handle it and who can't, or who it's okay and who it's not, who it might benefit, who it won't help at all, you know.
It's so hard because we're called upon to both make as much space as possible for our clients to have the experience they need to have while also being human and as accessible as they need us to be. And it's not always easy to strike the balance between those two.
Yeah, it's very, very, it's difficult. I mean, I think we just, in some ways, we just keep creating it as we go along, you know, but we always have to keep in mind that we have to be there for the patient. But, you know, I think we do also have to take care of ourselves. And I think that goes back to the first story we were talking about, I really, really hate you. You know, I think it's important to, you know, to realize for yourself, is this not benefiting me to do this, to be with this patient, you know, this narcissistic patient.
Right.
And if so, how maybe I should get out of this in a way that's, you know, decent for the patient, where I'll find them somewhere else, but not keep tearing open that wound,
right,
you know?
I loved the story, I'm not the right one for this job, by Megan Devine. I mean, what a devastatingly honest and raw story about feeling like an imposter, quitting the therapy profession. This is written by a therapist. And
yes.
then finding your way back after tragedy. And what I find refreshing is how there's not really a sweet, happy ending. After everything that's happened, she's still struggling with grief and doesn't feel she's as good of a person as she once was. How did this story impact you?
And she was actually one of the first ones who I contacted because she runs a grief group, and you know, her husband had died. She was a young widow, and then that drove her to have to leave therapy and to do all different kinds of things, and then she found her way back. But we were Facebook friends, and I knew about her grief work and that she was a therapist. So I just, you know, I just asked her. I said, we discussed it a bit, and she just gave me this gorgeous story. And yeah, and she was writing about in the beginning, having, you know, real feeling that I have this imposter syndrome, you know, and we all, you know, many of us feel that we have that, but you know, in her case, she felt she was in such a place of suffering, grieving, that she could not do the job. And then when she felt that she had healed enough, she could go back. And her last line in the story, is, "I am who you think I am, but I am not who I was. Don't look up to me, and I'm the right job." And I think that's all about the flawed healer.
That's right. And you know what made this story unique for me, at least, is that I think everyone can relate to, in the beginning, feeling like an imposter. But she writes about how even after being in private practice for 5 years, she still felt like an imposter. The feeling was not going away.
Right.
And I honestly thought the story was going to end with her realizing this was not the profession for her. When she ends up coming back, that's the part I didn't expect to happen.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that she kind of found her niche now with running the grief groups, you know, and doing that work. And I think that helped her heal too. But yeah, I'm sorry, but you were going to make a point.
Well, I was, without naming names, I was going to ask you, if you think, you know, inspired by this story, do you think that there are therapists out there who shouldn't be therapists?
Absolutely. And a lot of the stories in this book, some of the patient stories are writing about horrific therapist experiences that they've had. Laura Bogart wrote a beautiful story, My Shrink's Ultimatum. And basically, her therapist helped her heal from a lot of abuse that Laura had gone through in her life. But then her therapist was fixated that Laura was, you know, a heavy woman, you know, and she was insisting that Laura had to lose weight. That was part of, you know, the condition of them continuing therapy, that Laura had to love and respect herself enough to lose weight. And Laura writes, she was trying to do that for a while, but then she realized that's not who she was or who she wanted to be in that moment, and she left that therapist. And then she found a therapist who has accepted her for who she is and the weight that she wants to be.
So then what do you think it takes to be a therapist? Who makes a good therapist?
And, you know, and again, the whole therapists are people too, so we are who we are. And so not all of us will be able to, perhaps, I think we do the work differently depending on who we are. And that's why therapists have to have therapy. You have to know yourself and understand yourself and all your issues and all your triggers and all your prejudices and all of those things. And I think that's an essential requirement of being a therapist. And I think also it would have been very helpful for Laura Bogart's therapist to have supervision. I don't know if she was, because I think it was awful what she was doing to Laura. So I think it's essential for a therapist to realize that we are flawed. We are human. Maybe we make mistakes. I know I have mistakes that I've made with patients that I feel badly about looking back on, and I hope I've learned from them. I think we have to be open to, I think, realizing that we don't always know exactly. We just have to do the best we can for the patient, and not what we think the patient needs, but what works for them. So,
I think one of the last stories I want to bring up is by Binnie Klein, entitled, yes, "You're on the Air." because I thought you might be able to relate to it, because this is a story by a therapist about how she deals with the challenges of having a private psychotherapy practice and a public presence as a radio host. She seems to have embraced the dual roles, but I know that you do speaking and you do media such as this interview. Can you relate? You know, how do you balance the two roles in your practice and in your life as a speaker?
It can be challenging. And it's interesting because I love Vinny's story, and I had asked her to write it for me because she'd written another story that I seen that covered some of that material. And I thought, wow, that would really be great for the book. But she is happy to be in the book, but she's not participating in any of the media around it. Huh. I said to her, I guess you won't have me on your radio show. She said, I guess not. You know, because you're out there, but how much do you want to rub people's faces in it, I guess? But what was interesting is I just published a story that was out today on Garnet News, coming out to my therapy patients, because I have a lot of patients who are writers. Because again, my background is as a writer and a writing teacher. So I work with a lot of people who are struggling with issues about, procrastination and perfectionism. And if I don't get a book published, you know, what's wrong with me? And just thinking, well, when I get my book published, life will open up and the skies will, you know, be forever sunny and things like that. I thought, well, now, I kind of have to tell my patients that I have a book out and that it's a very personal book because I'm working with them on their stuff. And here I am now with a book. So I was kind of nervous about, you know, telling some of them this. You know, and one of them even wound up coming to a book signing. And, you know, and I talk about some of the stuff that I read from my essay at the book signing. And we had a very candid conversation, the contributors who were there in the audience, about therapy and our experiences, you know. And then she came for a session a couple days after that. And it really, she just said, it was fun being there. And then it was like, back to business and back to her life. I mean, in the end, it was where it should be, about the patient and not about me. But it is that kind of like that dance. Well, I don't want them to find out from, you know, just from reading about it. But on the other hand, it felt a little tricky.
How did your other patients respond, and how did you feel telling them about the book?
And, you know, it's like people have taken it in stride. It really hasn't been a big deal for them, which was a lesson for me. It's about them. It's not about me. So it was more my agonizing over, oh, my goodness, how do I tell? You know?
sometimes we're the ones having the issues, not them.
Absolutely.
Well, Sherry, this has been a real treat. Before you go, tell us, what are you working on now?
Well, now I'm doing a lot of publicity on the book. I'm going next week, actually, doing some book signings in L.A. and San Francisco. And right now, it's mostly my therapy practice and promoting the book, at least in the short-term future.
Well, congratulations again for the book. I really think people should go out and read it. And again, we've been speaking to Sherry Amadenstein, and the book is called How Does That Make You Feel? True Confessions from Both Sides of the Therapy Couch, published by Seal Press. Sherry, thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Take care. That was my interview with Sherry Amadenstein. If you haven't already, please let me know what you think about this and other interviews by me for New Books in Psychology. Just go to EugenioDuartePhD.com, that's EugenioDuartePhD.com, click on contact and shoot me a message. I'd love to hear your feedback, as well as suggestions of authors for future episodes. I look forward to hearing from you.